black, too strong. Too black, too strong.
Yo, Chuck, these honey drippers are still front on us. Show them that we can do this, cause we always do this. Ha ha, yeah, boy.
Bass, how low can you go? Death row? What a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal thief, public enemy number one. 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X bun. Now they got me in a cell, cause my records they sell. Cause a brother like me said, well, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you wanna listen to what he can say to you. What you wanna do is follow for now. Power the people say, make a miracle, keep up the lyrical. Black is back, all in, we're gonna win, check it out. I'm saying inside music that the critics are blasting me for. They'll never care for the brothers and sisters. Why, cause the country has us up for the war. We got to get them straight. Come on now, they're going to have to wait till we get it right. Radio stations are questioning their blackness. They call us a black, but we'll see if they'll play this. Bring the noise.
Hey, yo, Chuck, they illin'. We chillin'.
Bring the noise. The crowd runs with me, my DJ is warm. He's X, I call him Norm, you know. He can cut a record from side to side. So what the ride, the glide, what should be safer than a suicide? Soul control beat is the father of your rock and roll. Music for watching, for winching, you call a band.
And you are listening to Radio Regent. My name is Norman Richmond. And we're getting ready to interview Ewart Walters, the author of To Follow Right, a journalist's journey. That's his autobiography, which was published in 2011. And I met Mr. Walters at a different book list when he had his book opening there, or his book launch, pardon me. And Mr. Walters, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good today. I'm struggling with allergies and a cold for the whole month, but they seem to be on the way, and I'm just having to make sure I get rid of them once and for all.
I have the same problem, so we
it's widespread this year.
We are united
by an affliction of allergies. Yes.
Correct. Now you are. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, you're saying we are united, and I added by an affliction of allergies.
All right. last week, we've been speaking with people trying to form a relationship with African or black people all across Canada. We have some contacts, made contact with Halifax, Nova Scotia, so now we're in Ottawa. And your book, how is your book doing in terms of the selling of your book? And where can people get your book in Ottawa, and where can they get your book in Toronto?
Well, we printed 850 copies. I have about 8 left right here at home, and there are about 40 in Jamaica. I am going into a second printing shortly because the University of the West Indies at Carimac, the journalism school, is interested in getting some for its program. And I think there's the booksellers, book distributors in Jamaica are also interested in getting some. So I am going into a second printing shortly, and I'm looking forward to having that completed without too much difficulty.
You are speaking with you. I am speaking with you at Walters. Now you are the publisher of a newspaper called Spectrum. I'd like for you to give us a history of Spectrum and how people can pick up copies of Spectrum, or is it online, or can people go online and pick it up?
People can go online and see it if they go to blackottawa411.com. Because we are a monthly newspaper, it hasn't been practical to have our own website, but we make it available on a website that deals with black issues in Ottawa, blackottawa411.com.
Mm-hmm.
You will find the spectrum there.
Now, Black Ottawa, how many black people are in Ottawa? The last time I was in Ottawa, it was many years ago, and Ottawa was, I was there winter, and I never saw so much snow. It was colder than any other place I've ever been. And I didn't see too many melanin people with melanin at that time. But I understand there is a new Ottawa. There are people, a lot of new immigrants from, I guess, from the Somalia and the East Africa and the Caribbean. What does Ottawa look like in 2012?
Well, if you come during the winter when there's lots of snow, you're unlikely to see a lot of black people. But if you come during the school season and the summer and all that, and you go into places like the Rideau Center or the malls in St. Laurent Boulevard, you will see black kids, a lot of black kids. You won't see a lot of black people on the streets because, fortunately, most of them have jobs. but if you're downtown Ottawa at noon on a weekday, you will see public servants walking about and other people walking about, and you'll find a lot of black people. And yes, the recent, when I say recent, last 20 years has brought quite an influx of people from the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Eritrea, Tigray, and so on. And but the before that, the main group of black people would be from the Caribbean, from Barbados, Trinidad, Tobago, Jamaica, Guyana, and places like Grenada, and so on. They made up the bulk of Ottawa's black community for many years, starting in the, I would say, the late 50s.
Now, let me ask you, did I cut you?
No.
I wanted to ask you, what is the church situation in Ottawa now? When you first went to Ottawa as a person of African ancestry, if you wanted to go to a church or a mosque, how could you talk about what is the situation with the black folks and religion in terms of the church or mosque?
As far as the Muslims are concerned, I think there are two main mosques.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are, among other things, a big Friday afternoon gathering.
Juma.
As far as churches are concerned, it's a very interesting situation because black people from the Caribbean were Anglican, Roman Catholic, Baptist, Seventh-day Adventist, Wesleyan, all of the denominations you could think of, and to a large extent, you will find in all of those churches, or most of those churches in Ottawa, you'll find black people. But you'll also find that maybe over the last 40 years, there's been a substantial growth of Pentecostal churches in Ottawa, which are, for the most part, which have large black congregations. And also the Seventh-day Church has become mostly black congregations.
Seventh-day Adventists?
Hmm?
The Seventh-day Adventists, you said?
Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventist Church also has a large black congregation.
Mm-hmm.
But they count, I think, between them and one of the Pentecostal churches, the Ottawa Church of God, they have as many as 22 different nationalities attending.
Right. And what church do you attend?
I am a Baptist. In fact, I am the moderator of the Fourth Avenue Baptist Church. My entire family, my grandfather, my father, myself, have been Baptists all along, and that's where I am.
Was the Baptist Church influenced, not influenced, but wasn't there an African born in the United States that had something to do with the spread of the Baptist religion in Jamaica, or am I wrong?
You're not wrong. There was a man called Lyle who came to Jamaica during the time of slavery and helped to generate a lot of energy into Baptist work there, and he was revered to the extent that when Calabar Theological College for Baptists set up its institution at Red Hills Road, one of the lecture rooms was named for him, George Lyle.
Mm-hmm.
I think he spells his name L-E-I-L-E.
Right. Now, what does you have the spectrum, but what does the press look like in Ottawa in terms of are there any black radio shows how strong is the spectrum as a publication? Are African people in the media on I know we don't have any independent black anything in Ottawa. I shouldn't say that. We don't have any independent black we don't have a radio station or a TV station.
Yeah. You're asking me to cover the media waterfront in Ottawa. Let me try and see what I can do. For black people in mainstream media, daily media, that has remained as bad as it ever was. We have, as far as I know, one man here in Ottawa on the CBC television, Adrian Harewood.
Adrian Harewood used to be on this show.
That's right.
Right.
And that's about it. And if you walk through the CBC newsroom, you're not going to find more than one other black person, I don't think. For CTV, I think there is one person operating on the local television network who is black, and I believe CTV also has other black people on the wider thing, but not in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
As far as radio shows are concerned, there are a number of outstanding shows that are presented on the university stations.
Carleton University?
Carleton University and the University of Ottawa both mm-hmm. have major shows run by black people from about 10 o'clock in the morning right down to about 7 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly music shows, but also discussion shows. The program called Black on Black, run by mostly women, and that has a lot of discussion. Rockers also is a show that starts at 12 o'clock. It's a music show based mostly on reggae, but also has discussions. And at 3 o'clock, Reggae in the Fields with Junior Smith comes on for about 2 hours, again mostly a music show, but sometimes discussion and interviews of various people. And then there, in more recent times, there are shows that feature things African and things Haitian.
You are listening to Radio Region. I'm on the line with Hewitt Walters, and Hewitt Walters is the author of A Journalist's Journey. That's his autobiography, which was published in 2011. And
I should also add that as far as the mainstream daily newspapers are concerned, they have not really they haven't really done what is needed to be done in terms of having a black face or a black representation. The Ottawa Citizen has one black reporter. He's from Africa. I'm not even too sure if he's a full-time staff, and we don't see his work very often. And the Ottawa Sun, I don't know of any black reporters on it, on that staff. And the problem with the newspapers generally, not only in Ottawa, is that for the most part, they are now owned not by newspaper companies, but by conglomerates of one form or another. And they are far less committed to their, to the people in their communities than to their shareholders. And at a time when digital information is taking over, you would think that what the newspaper should be doing is focusing more on their communities. And like Toronto, the communities of non-white people are growing, while the white communities are not necessarily growing as fast or nearly as fast.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not reflected in mainstream media.
Not reflected in the mainstream. I wanted you, we have a few more minutes left. I know you have to get out of here, but I'd like basically for you to give you a chance to basically outline some of the awards that you have won, and you know, some of the before you do that, I would be definitely it doesn't make any sense for me to talk to you and not let you talk about, you have lived in three countries, Jamaica, the United States, and in Canada. And you, during the time of Michael Manley, when he was in power, you did a lot of work with Mr. Yeah. Manley, and there was a lot of behind the scenes intrigue, basically trying to get rid of Mr. Manley.
That's
Could you
right.
talk about that period?
Well, I don't know if you have noticed recently in the newspapers, there are stories coming out of Venezuela about toilet paper and
yes.
other products that have been hard to find, and lo and behold, they've found a warehouse somewhere in which all of these goods are hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not on this, on the supermarket shelves. Well, the same thing used to happen in Jamaica in the late 70s, where goods were scarce. And one of the reasons they were scarce is that somebody had paid the grocer or the supermarket manager to keep them off the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were a good customer and you went in and asked for certain things, you, with a wink and a nod, the supermarket owner could sell them to you in a brown paper bag, so people wouldn't know what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
That was just one of the many types of suppression that was fomented on the Manley administration when they wanted to get rid of him. But the main thing, the main activity with which I was connected was the press, the North American press, both in the U.S. and in Canada, and how the press was used by people who had money to persuade them to put Jamaica, to cast Jamaica in a bad light. In fact, up until 1989, every time there was an election in Jamaica, several parts of the Canadian press would descend on the country looking for violence. They stopped after 89 because the violence at election time has completely gone to nothing. There's no real election violence as there was in 76 and 1980. Those were the years when external forces were attempting to help the Jamaican opposition get rid of Manley. Today, Jamaica still has a very high murder rate. People maybe more people are being killed in Jamaica now than were being killed at that time, but no press is interested. And it's a wonder to me that the kind of interest that was taken in the 70s because of people being killed, ostensibly because of people being killed, is no longer being taken, although there are, you know, more people are disappearing.
And I understand I had a friend by the name of Milton Blake. You probably knew Milton, and he worked at Chin, and he was given instructions when Manley, they were having an election in Jamaica. I don't know what year, 80?
There were three elections that Manley was involved in, 76, 80, and 89.
Okay, this must have been it was 1980. He was basically told by his boss to go down to Jamaica and try to find something out about the Cuban connection. They wanted to, these forces were anti-Castro and anti-socialism, so they basically wanted to get some dirt on Fidel.
Yeah.
And he refused to go along with the program and subsequently was summarily dismissed.
Yeah, we have to recognize the good work that the Toronto Star did during that time because, there was a day in September 1976 when it published two large stories by a man called Arne Hakala, written by Arne Hakala, which were, as bad as you could find. There was one of them entitled Cuban Connection Brings Bloodshed to Jamaica. And nowhere in the story was that headline substantiated. In another story that they had, there were something like 23 errors of fact on the story, and the only objective of the story would have been to put Jamaica in a bad light. So we came and had a chat with the editor of the Star, who was Martin Goodman at the time, and after that, the Star completely changed, and they sent a young reporter down to Jamaica to cover the election. And
was that Hamlin Grange?
Did
they send Hamlin Grange to cover the election?
No. They sent a girl named Fulton, I forget her first name.
All right.
We said, when we heard she was going, we said, we'll not tell her what to do or anything. We are not putting any pressure on the Star. And we couldn't. She went and did her own thing, and she reported fairly on what was happening at the end of the election. The Toronto Star wrote an editorial that was very, very good, saying that Washington might not like the result of the election, but Canadian should come to the aid of the Prime Minister, Michael Manley. And there it was. Such an editorial was not written by anybody else. And the kind of coverage that Jamaicans continue to get in Toronto from the Toronto Star is salutary and good, and probably not replicated by any other newspaper in Canada.
Do you think, are you speaking of 2013? You think the coverage the Toronto Star gives is good?
Yes, comparatively, yes. Yes, compared to any other, I'm not comparing it with Share now or any of the community newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying compared to the Toronto Sun and maybe even the Globe and Mail, with whom we have had our differences from time to time. I don't know if you remember a time when there were people who were gathered out in the front of the Globe and Mail, Jamaicans and others.
Right.
Protesting their coverage of various things about Jamaica and Jamaicans.
I remember.
Yes.
Yes.
They too have improved, but it is the Toronto Star that has taken the most interest in the black communities of Toronto and in the Jamaican community.
What about the New York Times, the Washington Post? How have they treated Jamaica in particular and the Caribbean in general?
Well, if you add the Wall Street Journal to that, then I could
please
say that.
Add the Wall Street Journal, of course.
The Wall Street Journal has been particularly bad because its objective is not to deal with things as they are, but to deal with things in terms of the fact that the Wall Street Journal is the Bible of U.S. capitalism. I don't think I need to say more about them than that. The New York Times has been fairly even. The Washington Post, not as much. The Miami Herald, in those days, had a man called Don Boning, who was their main writer on things Caribbean.
You're talking Miami Herald?
The Miami Herald.
Oh, I definitely have to criticize myself for that, because of Miami publication should be in the mix when you're dealing with the Caribbean, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And Boning was, he wrote very often about the Caribbean, and I think he tried to straddle the whatever pressures he was having, but he often came up on the wrong side of things.
In terms of the TV side, the film side, how do you think black people in Canada and the Caribbean have been treated by the film and TV industry?
By the who?
Film and TV industry. And when I say that, I'm talking about our own community. Like, we had Sud Sutherland on this show, and he has done a film called Home Again about deportees to Jamaica, from one from Toronto, one from England, and one from New York. And I think that film has screened in Ottawa, if I'm not mistaken, but it's being screened, I think, today in Lagos, Nigeria, and it's going to be screened in Accra, Ghana. Did you see that film, Home Again?
No, I haven't seen that film, and I must confess I probably don't see as many films as I should, but if I can say anything at all about that side of the industry, it seems to me that it is mostly our own producers and filmmakers who have been making any headway in that area, that the large owners and producers of movies in America have not really been interested in that. In fact, most of the interest has been on things American. I mean, it's like some of the popular shows that you see, like Wheel of Fortune, where most of the questions have to do with American culture.
Right.
So it's going to be up to us, I think, to continue to develop any film industry or any sort of view of the Caribbean or of Africa in terms of how we see them. It is, we have to plead our own cause, as some important people in our history have said in the past.
You are listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Radio Regent. My name is Norman Richmond. I am speaking with Hewitt Walters, the author of a great book. And you said you could stay on until 12:30. With your permission, we will continue. But if you have to cut out, you only promised us a half an hour, so it's your call.
Yeah, I can go a little further.
Okay. let me ask you, this is a kind of a strange question, but, before Rob Ford became such an international personality, would you say that the most well-known Jamaican, or the most well-known Canadian, pardon me, not Jamaican, would be Donovan Bailey at one point? Don't you think Donovan Bailey when he won the world 1996 when he won the 100 meters. That's like being a heavyweight champion or winning the Super Bowl. Am I off when I make a statement like that?
Yeah, I think Donovan Bailey was had a good claim to that as being the best known Canadian. I suspect, though, that Ben Johnson had even a better claim. Partly because of his
controversy,
excellence, and partly because of the troubles that descended on him. So it could be either of those during that time, yes.
Yeah, well, that's the next question I want to ask you is about Canadian track and field and Jamaican track and field. Why do you think that you have so many Jamaican sprinters and you have athletes from the Caribbean? I think there was a brother that won a pole vault, won the pole vault. He was Trinidad and Tobago, or from Tobago, Trinidad or Tobago, or both, two countries. But anyway, talk about the Canadian track field. Canada hasn't seemed to come up with with anyone since 96, and Donovan and all those guys were basically trained by people outside of Canada.
Yes, I don't know how much geography has to do with it, because, you know, in places like Jamaica and Trinidad and Bahamas, the athletes can train all year round without having to go into any special buildings or any special arrangements. They can just train in the open air all year round.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is one of the features. But a feature of Canadian and British and American track and field is, in fact, athletes from the Caribbean, from Jamaica mostly, who have gone on to Canadian, American, and British teams and have done well. And the question arises, what cause that? And people are looking for a gene or looking for something, looking for yellow yam or ganja or something. What is it that caused it? And really, I think it is spirit. It is really a spirit that was engendered from as far back as 1952 when Herb McKinley, Arthur Wint, George Roden, and Les Lang burned up the track at the Olympics in Helsinki.
That was in 48?
A legend that just took the Jamaican imagination by storm and has never let go. Track and field doesn't cost anything much in terms of equipment. Most of the track and field companies, the people who produce spikes and so on, tend to give their spikes to coaches, and so the athletes get them free. Beyond that, they need very little. A pair of shorts and so on. It's not like hockey or cricket or even soccer to a lesser extent. And they can just run. The running comes natural to them, and they have seen that it can be done and that it has great rewards. So in countries where opportunities are not vast, in countries like developing countries like the Caribbean and so on, when an opportunity presents itself to young people through athletics, through track and field, they grab hold of it. It's not like in large countries where, you know, to make a living or to get ahead, you have a choice of so many different things. Their choices are more limited, and that is one of the things that propels them.
Well, one of the things I found out recently, I didn't know that actually Prime Minister Norman Manley not only was a lawyer, but he was a great track star as well. He was a 100 meters man. He was a sprinter.
That's right. He set the record for the 100 yards at his high school, Jamaica College, at 10 flat. I forget what year. And interestingly enough, the next person to come close to that was his son, Douglas, who equaled that time, again at Jamaica College. But Norman Manley was involved not only in track, but in horse racing, in boxing, in just about all the sports that Jamaicans played, and he helped to encourage people in sports because he was really the builder of the Jamaican nation through his through all of his activities, mostly through something called Jamaica Welfare, which he started even before he got into politics.
Well, let me ask you this, since we're talking about Norman Manley, or I'm talking about Norman Manley. Norman Manley, in 1957, Kwame Nkrumah invited a group of people to independence in Ghana, March 6th, and Norman Manley went, Dr. King went, I think Louis Armstrong had gone before. could you talk about, Jamaica's relationship with Africa, you know, beginning with Ghana? And my father-in-law used to always fiercely point out to me that Jamaica was among the first countries that supported, you know, the boycott of South Africa.
Yes, it was.
So could you talk about those two things?
Well, you see, Jamaica as a colonial country was really cut off from Africa and things African. And Norman Manley, as the real builder of Jamaica from, say, 1937 on, was one of the people who started to break down that barrier. Interestingly enough, you ask about 1957 and Ghana. That was the year, I think, that Ghana got independence.
Yeah, 1957, March 6th, right.
Yeah. And one of the things that Jamaica just got its second radio station, this one was the created by the government, and it not only had started to be a place where Jamaican culture and Jamaican music and Jamaican musicians could parade their skills. It also became the place where Jamaicans first heard high life music from Ghana.
From Ghana? Oh, okay.
And the Jamaica Broadcasting Corporation, it was. And that high life music from Ghana helped to sensitize Jamaicans towards their own independence. I mean, if Ghana could do it, why not Jamaica? And as you know, Jamaica became independent, 5 years later or something like that. And yes, Jamaica was certainly the first country in the Western Hemisphere, if not the first country in the world, to decide to ban products from apartheid South Africa. And since then, the relationship with various African countries has grown. Manley was particularly fond of Julius Nyerere of
Tanzania.
And there were other connections. Of course, he would have met some of these people while he was studying law in England, and they would have had discussions. But those were, Nyerere was the principal person that he was interested in, and who came to visit Jamaica, I think, twice.
I never knew that Nyerere had gone to Jamaica.
You didn't know that?
No, sir.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, he came at least twice.
Mm-hmm.
And his ideas certainly got prominence in Jamaica in the 70s.
Ideas.
But you ask about 1975, and Norman Manley. I think 1975 was also the year. No, not that. If sorry. 1975 would be Michael Manley.
Correct.
We're talking about 1957, you said.
1957, talking about the independence of Ghana.
1957 was also a great year in Jamaica because Norman Manley that year opened up education to the children of the masses.
Free education.
I think it was 2,000 free places for kids poor children in secondary schools who could not have gone to secondary schools before that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really significant year in the development of the country.
In terms of education, was that free education was in Trinidad and Barbados, I'm correct, and later the JLP would reverse the whole. When they came to power, didn't they take away, people had to pay for education again?
Well, free education, completely free education didn't come in, well, let's put it this way. The primary schools, the elementary schools were always free. It's secondary education that was not free.
Right.
And as I say, Norman Manley started on the road to that by giving free places to 2,000 children in 1957 on. But in 1973, Michael Manley, as Prime Minister, opened up free secondary education without any hindrance to all students, and also opened up, I think, free tertiary education at the University of the West Indies. And that went on for a while. It was curtailed when he was succeeded by the JLP after 1980, and they put a cess on education. And so that free education at the tertiary level disappeared, and I think might also have disappeared in the secondary level. I'm not too sure.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, except to thank you for this decision of yours to call me and give me this opportunity to speak with you. It's been an interesting time for me for the past 29 years with the Spectrum newspaper. I don't know how much longer I can continue it. I've been trying to see if I could get some interested young person to take it over to. Haven't succeeded with that yet, but nothing tried, nothing done.
Yeah, we need publications, but I guess you should continue to try to find some new blood to keep it going.
Yes.
I'm getting ready to ask a real dumb question. If you're putting out a publication from a city, you have to live in that particular city. I know technology is great, but if you're not living in an area,
right.
You can't really.
That's right.
You can be a correspondent, but
it's almost impossible.
Right. So you need someone.
You have to be relevant to your people.
Right. All right, Mr. Walters, I really appreciate you giving me this time. And do we have your permission to call you back and try to keep something going a couple of times a year?
No problem there.
All right, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have been speaking with Hewitt Walters of Ottawa, the publisher of the Ottawa Spectrum.
And he is Your wine and roll your behind, push it back, 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 march and take back, 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 hold on. tonight, tonight. I'm a wine on your till you're blue. Keep ballin' left, right, back, a push, left, right, back, push. Walk up the bass, walk up the bass. Left, right, back, push, left, right, back, push. All in the bass, walk up your waist. Let me see your wine, I roll it in time. Push it back, 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 right back, 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 back. Hold on, let me see you walk it, till you walk it out of control. I say walk it up.
With a brand new style. Come, my ladies, this is called the horsey.
Ride it!
Ride on your horsey!
Ride it time!
Get on your horsey!
right hand out. Next hand on your waist, then you bend your knees. Time to take a taste. Then wiggle and we wobble and we wobble and we wobble and we get on. Bad, 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 bad. Everybody say go!
Sometimes to be led from a beach.
and you're listening.